Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Delaware is teaming up with OpenAI on a certification program that state officials hope can build a local AI workforce.
Our focus from the beginning was to ensure that these certification opportunities are both accessible and that individuals have support so it can be a reality for anyone.
We learn more about the program from Delaware Labor Secretary Lucretia Moultrie. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also learn how a new grant will help Alzheimer's research at the University of Delaware and why employers are struggling to connect with Gen Z employees. Plus, Arts Playlist previews Delaware Shakespeare's annual community tour. It's all next on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. These days, it seems everyone is racing to get in on the fast-developing world of artificial intelligence, seeking any way and every way to plant their flag in the AI industry. That includes the state of Delaware, which recently announced it is the first state in the nation to join OpenAI's certification program, which is expected to deliver programming to schools and workforce training programs that allow students and workers to build AI fluency and earn certifications in AI tools. This comes on the heels of Governor Matt Meyer signing a joint legislative resolution to create an AI sandbox in the first state, basically a regulatory framework to encourage companies to pilot advanced AI tools here, temporarily easing regulatory constraints to spur breakthrough developments while keeping safeguards in place to protect consumers and the public. I recently sat down with Delaware Department of Labor Secretary Lucretia Moultrie to learn more about the OpenAI certification program and the benefits it could provide the first state. So before we dig into the program itself, how did the state get involved with OpenAI on this? How did this opportunity come about? So the other partners are the likes of Walmart, John Deere, Accenture, and the Texas Association of Business. How did Delaware wind up in that mix?
Well, I know you'll recall from the outset, Governor Meyer issued executive order number one. And with that executive order, he made clear that his top priority for the state was increasing the workforce and increasing training and opportunities, especially for youth. But when we have opportunities to be the first state to partner with OpenAI for a certification program, that's not only for the benefit of our youth, but our workforce as a whole. So it's a really exciting time.
And I guess one of the benefits of getting involved early like this is having a hand in shaping this program in ways that will fit Delaware specifically and be maybe tailored to Delaware and what its needs are.
Yes, absolutely. So with creating the Office of Workforce Development, you know, really the purpose of that office is to spearhead efforts to create the workforce of the future. And this is one way that we're going to do it. I know that AI has been quite the topic as of late in the public. But, you know, what we want to show is it creates an opportunity to reskill and upskill our workers so that they can contribute to the labor force of the future.
I realize this is still in the early stages, but it feels like there's maybe like two tracks here, schools and students and then businesses and workforce training. On the school side, is there a sense of how this might look? Is this potential career pathway in high schools, a certificate program at Dell Tech, a combination of those things?
I think a combination is the best way to describe it. So ultimately, this is one of several initiatives that the Department of Labor will be rolling out. But our focus from the beginning was to ensure that these certification opportunities are both accessible and that individuals have support so it can be a reality for anyone, no matter what age you are, what your education is, or what your skill level is. So that requires a lot of coordination with our community. And the schools, local organizations have really been receptive to labor's outreach with regard to collaborating and having partnerships so that we can roll this out seamlessly throughout the state.
Has there been conversations already about from schools about trying to get into kind of this AI area and provide opportunities for students who are interested in being part of the AI workforce and industry going forward?
The schools have been really excited about this opportunity. You know, one thing that they've noticed is that student interest in traditional higher educational experiences tend to waver over time, right? And the schools have always been really responsive in that they just want to make sure that when their students are out the door, they're prepared for the workforce or whatever else they choose to pursue. And according to the conversations that I've had with our local educational leadership, they think that certifications are a great enhancement to young people's resumes as they transition into the workforce directly or into higher education.
With the idea of higher education in mind, is there a role in this for UD, DSU? We think about certifications, we usually think about Delaware Tech and the high schools. Is there a role for a UD or a DSU in this program?
Absolutely. I mean, to the extent that they have an interest in providing these certifications, these are just additional enhancements to any student's resume, right? So they can not only earn their traditional degrees, but they can get various certifications to demonstrate their competence in other areas.
How about on the business workforce training side? What are you hoping for there? Is there a sense of what that might look like?
Right. We really look forward to partnering with businesses because we know that AI is going to have an impact over these next few critical years. And the best thing that we can do as labor is assist them and provide them with resources to upskill their workers so that they can use AI confidently and competently.
Secretary Moultrie, is there also an element here for people who aren't necessarily looking for an AI industry job, but want to have AI fluency to better incorporate AI into their current work, or maybe businesses that want AI fluent workers?
Yes, absolutely. I think that this is a trend that we'll see happening relatively normally in the near future with regard to AI. AI will be leveraged by employers to create workplace efficiencies. So it is definitely to an employee's benefit or a potential worker's benefit to have competency in the skill set of using AI.
The state also recently embarked on creating an AI sandbox to encourage startup and established businesses to come to Delaware to pilot advanced AI tools. Do you see this certification program as intrinsically connected to the concept of building an AI sandbox in Delaware?
Absolutely. As I mentioned earlier, you know, the opportunity to reskill and upskill workers is just preparing Delaware's workforce for the jobs of tomorrow.
Can you walk us through a little bit of how this is going to roll out? What's first?
So we've already been in conversations with schools, local organizations, private employers, and they've been very receptive to creating designated spaces and/or utilizing school resources to ensure that when we make these certifications available, people in our community not only find them accessible, so it doesn't matter what technology they have available to them at home, but they will have a place to go to access the technology necessary to complete their certifications and also have access to support. So, to the extent that they're not the type that's inclined to independently complete a certification program, they will have individuals prepared to support them so that they can complete the programs.
Is the idea to maybe pilot it a couple places to kind of work out the kinks and then grow from there?
Exactly. So I know you can tell that I'm keeping some of the details close to the vest, but that's because we have some exciting partnerships to announce in the very near future. But your suggestion is pretty much spot on.
Is there a timeline in your mind for getting a fully formed version of this out there and up and running?
Oh yes, certainly before year end.
So it'll be the pilot programs within that before the end of the year, then grow from there in future years.
Exactly. Depending on the partner, I think the program can look different ways. And depending on the needs of our community, we want to make sure that these programs are tailored for community success.
And I imagine that also means making sure it's accessible up and down the state in all three counties, that type of accessibility as well.
Yes, absolutely.
So how high is the ceiling for this in your mind? How much potential do you feel like this holds for Delaware and its workforce?
Oh, I mean, I think it would be, I think it would be unfair to project the potential because I think it's enormous. I would not even seek to guess the extent to which this can positively impact our community. I think as labor, what we see our role as is being a critical connection from the community to obtaining these resources. So we just want to make sure that we are making these programs accessible so that we can support the development of our workforce.
And I imagine it's such a fast developing, fast moving area. Being first and taking that first step is perhaps the most important thing.
Absolutely. But I'm confident that the state of Delaware will create a model for other states to follow.
Thanks to Delaware Department of Labor Secretary Lucretia Moultrie for joining us on The Green this week. And stay with us. We'll explain how a new Delaware Community Foundation grant will help Alzheimer's research at the University of Delaware. That's next on The Green, here on Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. The Delaware Community Foundation this week announced a five-year, $13.1 million grant to the Delaware Center for Cognitive Aging Research. The money will help further the center's research by expanding the number of participants in clinical studies, creating new forms of testing to find biomarkers which predict Alzheimer's disease development, and fund the purchase of an MRI machine, a critical tool for the diagnosis of cognitive aging. Earlier this week, Delaware Center for Cognitive Aging Research Director Dr. Christopher Martens joined Delaware Public Media's Israel Hale to explore what this financial boost means for their research.
This new investment, can you give us the details on that?
Sure. So I'll back up a step too. Last year, the Delaware Community Foundation gave us a $575,000 grant to initiate what we call the Delaware Longitudinal Study for Alzheimer's Prevention, or DELSAP. So this is a cohort study, meaning we recruit a large group of people from within our area, and we study various aspects of brain health from their cognitive function. And then the portion that DCF really helped kickstart was a study on biomarkers of Alzheimer's disease, so MRI scans and blood work to look for things that may pertain to future Alzheimer's risk. And after a year of doing this, we collected baseline data in a group of people and then went back and had a conversation with them about our vision for growing the center and growing this longitudinal study, which would enable people to come back on an annual basis to have some of these things measured so that we can track changes in brain health over time. And so this investment helps us by investing in this DELSAP study. It allows us to continue making those measurements on people in our area for the next 5 years. It also funds a new MRI scanner that will be placed on the University of Delaware's STAR campus, which is where most of our health sciences research takes place. And it'll fund several sub-projects or impact projects by UD faculty that are focused on new strategies for detecting Alzheimer's disease decades before any cognitive symptoms occur. It'll fund clinical research focused on women's health and risk of Alzheimer's disease. And it will even fund a clinical trial in perimenopausal women who are potentially at greater risk for Alzheimer's disease. It'll also fund new cutting-edge MRI imaging tools that can be used to detect changes in the brain that occur, like I said, decades before even some of the noticeable cognitive symptoms emerge. And these are important because if we can detect the disease well before any symptoms occur, then we might have a better chance at intervening and actually stopping the what we all know as the symptoms of dementia from ever occurring.
Can you also tell me how this will grow the number of researchers in Delaware as well?
Sure. So, with the investment in our longitudinal study, the DelSAP study, we're growing a cohort of people who we are studying their cognitive function and other biomarkers. And at the same time, we're growing a registry of participants who are interested in getting involved in other research studies. And so, as our center does the work to recruit people into our registry and our longitudinal study, this enables other faculty members at the university to start their own clinical research projects and recruit from the registry. So people that enroll in our DelSAP study are given opportunities then to enroll in future research studies that come along. There's a lot of work that goes into just screening people for eligibility into research studies. And so our center really serves as a hub for taking care of some of that difficult work that goes into finding the people and then connecting them to studies that might be a good fit for them. The funding of a new MRI scanner will benefit Alzheimer's research as well as other research areas within health sciences by bringing this technology to our health sciences campus where all of this research is taking place. And so this will draw in new faculty members who previously have not been able to engage with MRI research for various reasons. It'll allow us to scan clinical populations that are coming to our campus to interact with our various clinics. And so this will just ultimately strengthen the research infrastructure around brain aging and Alzheimer's disease at UD. You know, right now our center has been working across campus and drawing in faculty that are already here at the University of Delaware who are engaged in research that I would say is adjacent to Alzheimer's research. We know now that modifiable lifestyle factors like getting regular physical activity or eating a healthy diet or maintaining proper blood pressure are big risk factors for dementia due to Alzheimer's disease. And we have a number of faculty here at the university who are experts in studying many of these lifestyle factors. And so, what this grant enables by building our research registry and our longitudinal study is it enables some of those faculty members to actually join us and actually start doing and engaging in some Alzheimer's related research. So, adding that to their ongoing research portfolio. It will also enable the funding of new graduate students and postdoctoral researchers. So it will draw new minds to the university to come and work with us on the ongoing research projects. And so all of that will synergize research at the University of Delaware and then hopefully, create partnerships for new research throughout the state as well.
If there's an adult out there that would want to maybe participate in the science to help with the research of Alzheimer's and, dementia research, how can they get involved? Is there a path for them to get involved?
Yes, absolutely. So we have a website. It's udel.edu/decar, DECCAR. And on that website, the people who are interested in engaging with our research can click a button to join our Brain Health Registry. And we have a team of staff that can reach out to them and get them scheduled for a visit that would start the process of learning about how to become involved in research at the university. It's sort of a multi-step process. Some people can join our registry and just receive information about studies that they may be eligible for. Others can join our longitudinal study and receive access to things like cognitive testing and biomarker testing for Alzheimer's disease risk. And then, hear from us on an annual basis to kind of track their brain health over time. And so once participants get involved in either of those, then we start to reach out to them about several of the other studies that are happening on campus, whether it be a clinical trial or some other study that's focused on trying to understand how or why things change in the brain as we get older. So joining our participant registry, we call it the Brain Health Registry, is the first step to getting involved in all of our research here.
The increase in participants, it looks like from 100 to around 500. Can you also speak on what an increase in participants, especially by that much, will do procedurally? What is the plan to accommodate, you know, going from 100 participants to 500 participants and actually collecting all that data?
Yeah, so you know, it takes a large sample of participants to really understand how the brain changes, because things change slowly over time and are a little bit different in different people. So having a large group of people is critical for us to be able to understand different trajectories of cognitive decline. Our first cohort of 100 people was really just to capture a baseline and look cross-sectionally, comparing people who were already exhibiting cognitive impairment compared to people who weren't. But being able to study those people longitudinally over several years or even decades will really allow us to understand changes over time that occur in some people and not in others. And so our goal and what this funding will enable is for us to grow that participant size up to about 500 people and then maintain it at that level, which means some people will drop out of the study or move on, and others will take their place to kind of maintain a cohort size of around 500. And that will ensure that we have continually making these assessments annually. Growing the size of our database will allow our researchers to access the data that we generate for their research. So with that, you know, the infrastructure required to be able to do that kind of research involves a lot of staff who can help with recruitment and making measurements on people and, you know, coordinating the storage and analysis of the data. So it's a large puzzle that needs to be fit together. And, you know, this support will really help us put us over the edge of what we need personnel-wise to be able to handle something of that capacity.
Let's talk about the future. Obviously, what you guys are going to do seems pretty well established, but I guess my question would be about when is it going to happen? As far as maybe from the outside looking in, when would somebody start to tangibly see some changes as a result of this funding? Obviously, you know, stuff like this doesn't just happen overnight.
Yeah, so, you know, because this is partially funding the continuance of our DelSAP study, we've already enrolled participants in that study over the past year. And so people who were enrolled over this past year are now eligible to come in for follow-up visits, and we can continue to enroll more participants. So this will just continue to you know, expand the size of that study that is already underway. So the DelSAP is an ongoing study that people can enroll in now. At the same time, we're actively working to you know, develop the space to house the MRI scanner on our STAR campus. And several of these side projects that I mentioned are already underway. So, you know, we've really been able to hit the ground running once this funding was delivered, to be able to start expanding offerings to older adults in our region for engaging in research. And so this includes expanding our reach beyond just the Newark, Wilmington area, but actually enrolling people from a broader radius, which will enable more Delawareans and people in southern Pennsylvania and parts of Maryland and New Jersey to engage in our study as well. So we're hoping that, you know, with this infusion of new funding, that we can scale up the projects that we've already had underway over the past year and really allow more people to benefit from participating in research.
Thanks to Delaware Center for Cognitive Aging Research Director Dr. Christopher Martens and our Israel Hale for joining us on The Green this week. Up next, Arts Playlist, and a look at Delaware Shakespeare as it takes a road trip with the Bard on its annual community tour. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. For 8 years now, Delaware Shakespeare has been leaving the boards and hitting the road for its annual community tour, taking the Bard's plays to neighborhoods around the First State. This year, Del Shakes presents Two Gentlemen of Verona. And on this edition of Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny spends some time with Del Shakes producing artistic director Mariah Gantz to learn more about the tour and this play.
First of all, tell me about the community tour, its history, and the purpose of doing this community tour.
Absolutely. So Del Shakes is in our eighth year of producing the community tour. It was originally designed with the intention to bring art to folks who perhaps otherwise wouldn't have access to theater, especially Shakespeare. And over the years, we've continued that mission. We go to non-traditional performance spaces across the entire state of Delaware over the course of 3 weeks. So we go to prisons, we're going to library spaces this year, a couple of community centers, and then a couple of spaces like Easter Seals for folks with disabilities. It's a really exciting way to help break down the barriers that make access to theater otherwise really difficult. And for me personally, it feels exciting to be able to bring art directly to people in their backyard.
Yeah, sort of eliminating those barriers. I mean, sometimes just the act of going to a theater, going to a concert, going to an art show can be really intimidating for people who have never been before and think that there, you know, is this kind of esoteric rules about how you're supposed to act, right?
Absolutely. I think people hear, especially Shakespeare again, and they think, oh, I have to come ready to understand every single thing. And again, going to see theater, people are like, well, I have to pay for really, really expensive tickets. I have to be worried about parking. And that's the hope with a lot of these going to community spaces that people have a relationship with. You know, it's just the library that you go to pretty often. You know how to get there, how to get in for parking. And we try to make it as easy as possible. I also think that there's something specific about the storytelling of the community tour that leans towards being able to make folks understand it even more, because we do the story in the round. And so for folks who don't know theater as well, that means that the actors are performing directly in the center with audience members sitting around them on four different sides. And I think that really allows people to feel so much closer to the action. We do a lot with our setup as well before and even at intermission at the end of shows, where the actors go around and they talk to the audience members. It feels really important to show that, you know, these are just everyday people who just happen to be actors doing this play. And I think that also helps to break down that kind of facade of, I won't understand what these people are talking about. They're up there on this stage. There's so much distance between us. But instead, we really try to remove a lot of that.
Is it difficult to take Shakespeare to audiences who may not be super familiar with his work? What are the challenges associated with that?
I actually think it's better sometimes, because I think when you're bringing Shakespeare to people who have a preconceived notion, they know what the story is, or they have a way in which they want to see it performed. So I find it really exciting actually to go to places where folks maybe don't have access to Shakespeare. I think we also get to take some of our more challenging stories on the community tour, specifically because people won't exactly know what it is. I mean, we get such a great joy out of taking Romeo and Juliet. That was one of the first community tours that I saw, and that resonated incredibly well with audiences. With these last couple of years, we've done some of his more problem plays like Cymbeline, The Winter's Tale. Two Gents isn't exactly a problem play, but it exists in a world where there's high amounts of comedy, but also a lot of questioning from the characters about their choices and who they are, where they're going, the people they're in love with. And so I think it's actually really exciting to take it to people who don't know, don't have a preconceived notion of what to expect. I think if there's any challenge, it really is just encouraging people that they don't have to know every single word that the actors are saying. I think people can get pretty hung up in making sure they understand every point of the story, but that is just so far from the truth. You can let the actors do all that work of showing you what you need to know based off of their emotions, their responses, and just getting a feel from it.
You know, I think that's a really, really interesting point. I think that when we think about art forms or even particular pieces of art that may not be familiar to us, and I think in the world of the theater, this is especially true, it can feel like you're going in alone, but actually, no. I mean, let the actors do the work. Let the director do the work. Let the musicians do the work. You enjoy the experience, right?
Absolutely. I think that is another thing that people feel they have to kind of do their homework before they go see Shakespeare. They think they have to know the story beforehand in order to get the most out of it. And don't get me wrong, like, if you want to watch a little video on YouTube and get the summary, go off. But I think there's something so beautiful to going into seeing a show and not knowing everything when you walk in, really letting every single thing that you're seeing in front of you influence your understanding. Because exactly like you said, the director, the set designer, they've all taken the time, the actors, the costumes, they've all taken the time to think a lot into every single choice that you're seeing. I love going to these performances at the community tour and hearing people afterwards have different understandings of what that symbolized or what that moment meant. I think that's really important, actually. There's no one specific right answer. Theater, and especially Shakespeare, is not meant for people to have, you know, one clear, cohesive understanding. Theory, it's not. I think it's so much more beautiful for people to be able to bring their own experiences and understandings and come away with it from the show with something that's particular to them. That's just as much theater as understanding the story, knowing the summary plot.
So the play for this year's tour, Two Gentlemen of Verona, what's the story? What can people expect to see?
Absolutely. So it is about two best friends, Proteus and Valentine, who have been best friends their entire life. Valentine decides to set off for Milan, and he's going to go and find himself, do some of his adult growing up. And while he is there, he ends up falling in love with a woman, Sylvia. And back home, Proteus has been in love with Julia for forever, and they exchange rings. And Proteus decides to follow after Valentine. He's actually set off by Julia's father. And once he arrives in Milan, he ends up falling for Sylvia, who Valentine was in love with. And naturally, comedy ensues. And we have people appearing, dressing up in disguise, disguising themselves as a man. We have clowns, like we said. We have the puppet of a dog. So it's kind of a big hodgepodge of a lot of Shakespeare's threads that you see throughout in different stories. Crisscrossed lovers. There's a lot of exchanging of letters, which we see in a lot of other Shakespeare plays. Yeah, there's a lot of different Shakespeare threads throughout. And you have to come and see just exactly how Proteus and Valentine are able to deal with their dedication to each other. Do they remain friends, or do we have another, do they have to find another way to move forward with their lives?
I'm thinking like a Renaissance era buddy comedy, basically.
Exactly is that. I've called it a buddy comedy several times. Our artwork, I think, really speaks to that too. The two guys playing Proteus and Valentine are great, and they actually just came off of doing a buddy play a couple of months ago. So they're already super locked in and really doing a great job of showing that.
We talked a little bit about why the community tour is so important for audiences, but I've got to think the company gets a lot out of this as well.
Absolutely. Somebody asked me, how do we cast for this? And it's so much of a unique casting process, because you really are, we end up doing essentially not an interview, but you know, you come in and you do your sides, but we have a long conversation about upwards of 5 minutes minimum, talking to people about the community tour and making sure people really understand these are going to be long days. Sometimes we drive all the way down to Lewis and do a performance and come back. It's also performances where you get into a routine, I would say, in a typical quote unquote theater audience, where you know the points where audiences are going to laugh. You know where they're going to be shocked. But because we go to so many different locations with different populations, it's different every single time. And so you as an actor have to be prepared to receive that as well. You have to be prepared that, you know, it doesn't matter also what their responses are. Not that it doesn't matter, but that you can't take what their response is for you having done something wrong or you having done something right even. It really is them responding in a way that is most true to themselves. And I spend a lot of time talking with the actors about that during auditions, about, you know, being prepared for this to not be the typical theater experience. I hear a lot from the actors that they really enjoy these moments of getting to do something a little bit different, getting to feel more connected to their audience members. It's really special.
And getting to share something that you're passionate with somebody who maybe is not familiar with it.
Exactly that. Exactly that.
So some of these shows are free. Is that right?
Yeah. In tradition with the community tour, its origins, we've kept a few performances free, especially the performances, like I said, at Easter Seals that are closed performances. We want to make sure we're taking art to those folks who otherwise don't have access. And then we have a couple of other free performances in community spaces like Jefferson Street Center / Hanover Presbyterian, Christina Cultural Arts Center. Some of those spaces have free performances, but we're also rolling out a few more ticketed performances this year. So yeah, we're trying a few different things this year and excited to see how audiences respond.
Thanks to Delaware Shakespeare's producing artistic director, Mariah Gantz, and our Martin Matheny for joining us on this edition of Arts Playlist. Delaware Shakespeare launches its annual community tour on October 1st. For tickets and performance locations, visit delshakes.org. And for a more in-depth version of this conversation, including the logistics of taking the Bard on the road, visit delawarepublic.org. And we wrap up The Green next with Enlighten Me, where we learn why many employers struggle to connect with Gen Z employees. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. The United States saw 22,000 new jobs added in July, far lower than the 186,000 jobs added monthly on average in 2024. And some of the jobs posted aren't even real. They're put up by AI, or are ghost positions, which companies put up in case they have to hire for a role that's currently filled. Gen Z job seekers are having a particularly difficult time finding work out of college. They're ghosted, put through 5 interview-long processes, and made to wait weeks for responses. On this edition of Enlighten Me, Delaware Public Media's Abigail Lee sits down with University of Delaware Learner Career Services Director Jill Ponte to discuss how Gen Z job seekers and their potential employers can better get through the hiring process.
Can you just talk about what, broadly, what's going on in terms of the hiring space for Gen Z? What does that look like right now?
The word that I use to describe kind of what's going on right now is it's a little wonky. The job market right now, it's stressed. There's certainly a slowdown in the amount of jobs that are out there that employers are hiring for. The job process itself is much longer than it's ever been before, at least in my lifetime. So from, you know, the time that you apply to the time that you maybe even get an interview is increased, you know, 2 to 3 times. And I think overall, it's a tough job market. However, there's still opportunity out there, especially for this generation, these rising leaders. Has it slowed down? Yes. Is it longer? Yes. Is there still opportunity out there? Absolutely. But you have to kind of sift through it, and that takes a lot of time and energy. It can be a little defeating, a little deflating as well. And so I think you have to have a lot of perseverance and a lot of energy to keep moving in this job market. There's so much negativity in the headlines these days, right? And I'm saying it right now. Jobs are down. The process is longer. And so I think you do also have a lot of people out there that have given up before they've even tried. The biggest advice that I can give for any job seeker is to keep with it and to surround yourself with a community of people who are going to provide you encouragement, provide you with mentorship, provide you with some coaching.
Can you talk about what the job market looks like in Delaware specifically for young people? But what are you seeing from potentially students here looking or people reaching out to you who are from or in Delaware? Yeah. What are we seeing around here?
I think it's the same everywhere, right? I mean, the job market is a little stressed. We're not seeing, we are seeing a lot of opportunity out there. And if I can sort of, you know, maybe talk about the Lerner College just a little bit in University of Delaware, the students here, you're a Gen Z, the students are motivated. They want to get experience. They have an incredible entrepreneurial mindset. They want to get experience the minute they step on campus as a first-year student, and they want to have mentorship, and they want to have people lead them. And we have some great partnerships with companies, especially with our newly launched Lerner Co-op program. So our co-op program we just launched last year, and these are solely working with companies in the state of Delaware who want to hire a student for a longer internship. So not just like your typical 8-10 week summer internship. This is like a year-long internship. But again, we saw almost 200 employers at our career fair last week. We saw almost 50 employers at our finance, information, systems, and accounting-focused career fair 2 weeks prior to that. So we're still seeing employers coming, they're hiring, they're wanting to engage with students, and we're seeing the students, the Gen Zers, just taking hold of every single opportunity that they can to especially getting in front of those employers and getting that personal touch.
I don't want to focus on just the negative, but there is a lot of negative to talk about. You know, we're seeing in August, we saw unemployment go up by 4.3%. That's according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. And we lost 13,000 jobs in June. We're also seeing fewer new jobs coming up. So it was an average of 27,000 the last 4 months compared to 186,000 average a month in 2024. That's a pretty steep decline. Can you talk a little bit about what does that look like for the average person experiencing that?
On top of all of that, you also have a significant percentage of jobs that are out there that are actually, they're fake. Meaning that employers are either posting jobs, but they don't have any budget or intention to hire, or you have actual fake postings that are put up by AI or things. So not only are things decreasing, but now you have, I read recently, anywhere between, you know, 18 to 36% of jobs that are posted out there are these fake job postings, or that the job just, it's an evergreen job and it's been up for 2 years and people are just collecting resumes. You're already going through a whole bunch of stuff. You're trying to sift through jobs, making sure, is this an actual job? Are they actually hiring? Let me look at the company. Let me see if I can find somebody at the company that I can actually talk to instead of going through, you know, just like an AI screening. But a lot of companies right now, they've taken a little of that personal touch outside of the job hiring, meaning they're utilizing AI tools to screen resumes. They're using AI tools to screen like an initial interview. And again, as a job seeker, it's super frustrating because then there's nobody that I can talk with and there's nobody that I can reach out to inquire about my job. I can just keep refreshing my browser and seeing if the status has changed on my application. So I'm a big believer in never sit and wait. Let's take some action. We have a lot of jobs out there that are actually real. Let's start applying to those. Let's start following those companies on any, whatever social media that you have. If it's LinkedIn, if it's Instagram, I'm a big proponent of LinkedIn. Let's start following those companies. Let's see what sort of connections that we can make. Let's utilize the people that we're connected to. Let's post on LinkedIn and tag that company that you just applied to that position. Let's put yourself out there. Let's work with our university alumni relations, our career services centers to see what sort of connections that they have. Job fairs that are public, so you can actually go in and talk to somebody and kind of get a feel for what their hiring process is like. So never sit and wait. Always move forward and keep organized.
I'm part of Gen Z. I've experienced this when I was looking for jobs about a year and a half ago at this point. I had a spreadsheet that had every single job that I'd applied to and whether or not I'd sent a follow-up email, whether or not I had connected with, you know, searching for alumni who work there. You know, I have a friend who she's been looking for 4 months at this point, which yeah. I have other friends who have looked longer, but she's just hitting roadblock after roadblock. So what can, I guess I'll ask from the employer perspective, what do we want to see from employers? How do we want to see improvements on their side?
What you're describing is so true and what is happening. There's a lot of mistrust in the whole hiring process on both sides, right? And so no one's really playing nice in the sandbox right now, or so it seems. For me, you know, if I could, you know, have influence over employers and their recruitment and hiring process, one, I'm not a big fan in having AI being used as the first screen. Now, for large companies who may not have the HR resources, they don't have the people, they don't have the bandwidth to be able to read through every single resume, I get that. I think the second step, which I think is really key, is transparency on the employer side. So start from the beginning, transparency in your job description. How long typically from application to hiring does it take for a candidate to get through? And then what are some of the steps in there? Also put on there, what steps have candidates taken that have been successful? Whether or not they've done certain things to their resume, how they've prepared for their interview, things that they've researched about the company to be able to answer that question, why do you want to work for us? Put the tips on there. Don't make it difficult.
So what I'm hearing is, you know, treating AI as rather than the complete first step, AI would be a supplement to the human, you know, first eyes on resumes.
Absolutely. I do think, I mean, AI is here. It helps us in our everyday jobs. At least I know it does, you know, for me. But I do think in the hiring process, it has to be a hybrid approach. It cannot just be all or nothing. Make the adjustments to your resume in order to get through our AI screening. So for example, some AI screening tools that candidates use cannot read tables. They can't read graphics.
From the employee's perspective, what can Gen Z hopeful workers do, which you've kind of touched on, you know, check for if there are ways that they can adapt their resume. But let's say that's not the case, which at least in my experience, none of the jobs that I applied to had. If we use an AI screen, do XYZ in order to improve your chances, what can we do in that probably traditional and most common situation to get through?
I love that you use the word traditional, because I do find that employers are a little behind in kind of updating their hiring practices. And again, they're missing out on some amazing candidates. And so, right, we can't change that overnight. Find a mentor, find somebody or multiple people that can almost serve as, for lack of a better word, your executive board. Somebody that is going to check in on you every day or every other day. This is not just your best friend. Maybe it is a former coworker. Maybe it's a professor. What I'm really trying to say is don't do this alone.
So a lot of what I'm hearing is that from the employer and the prospective employee side, from the Gen Z to, you know, whoever's hiring us, is to lean more on people. Can you talk a little bit about why it's important to lean on the people around you when we're talking about career?
The job search is exhausting. And how do you stay motivated, right? And if you're doing this alone, you know, sooner or later, the pep talks that you're giving yourself are just now, they may be spiraling into negative comments. You need to have people to listen to you. You need to have people to advocate for you. when you start putting yourself out there, making yourself maybe a little bit vulnerable, I know it doesn't feel good, but asking for help, I think people are going to want to rally around you and be able to help in any way that they can do. That's why I tell people too, if you're looking for a job, blast it out on social media. If it's not a secret, right? If you're not currently employed and you want to keep it from your current employer, but if you don't care who knows that you need a job, put it out everywhere. TikTok, LinkedIn, I don't care. Put a sign on the back of your car looking for a job. Like, I do think that once we put ourselves out there, I think people are going to want to help.
Thanks to University of Delaware Learner Career Services Director Joe Ponte and our Abigail Lee for enlightening us this week. And we've reached the finish line for this edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter there by clicking newsletters at the top of the page. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page or by emailing us at thegreen@delawarepublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make this week's show possible, Delaware Public Media's Israel Hale, Abigail Lee, and Martin Matheny. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind.